Research, www.
And welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, now being broadcast live on UPRN 105.3 New Orleans. My name is Dee Andrew, and tonight my guest is Dr. David Budiak. Before I get to introducing my guest, I have a few announcements I need to make. On CNN all week next week at 6 a.m. Eastern Time, their program, American Morning, they are running a special series called In Search of Aliens. On Monday, some of these topic names are kind of misleading, but on Monday, their topic is not just crazy, touching on people who have seen or believe that UFOs are real. On Tuesday is Roswell Revisited. On Wednesday is Close Encounters, dealing with the abduction phenomenon. On Thursday is Call 1-800-ALIEN, please, dealing with the search for extraterrestrial intelligence using radio telescopes. And on Friday, it's the Mars Worm, dealing with the what appears to be a fossilized worm photographed by the Opportunity rover. And also I'd like to remind everyone about the Truckers UFO Reporting Center. If you're a truck driver who has had a UFO sighting, we'd sure appreciate it if you would go to www.tuforc.com and fill out the online report form. And I promise you all personal information is kept confidential, but you can also fill out the form and remain anonymous if you wish. And I'd like to mention our newest friends of the Two Fork site, the Roundtown UFO Society, or RUFOs, up in Circleville, Ohio. This group was formed by several longtime UFO researchers. If you're in the Circleville area, RUFOs also hosts monthly meetings for anyone interested in the UFO topic. I'd like to thank the members of RUFOs for their support in helping us get the word out about the Truckers UFO Reporting Center. And I invite everyone to check out their website at www.roundtownufosociety.com. And my guest tonight, Dr. David Budiak, has a bachelor's in physics and a doctor of optometry from the University of California, Berkeley, plus his graduate training in biophysics and neurophysiology. In ufology, Dr. Rudiak's main area of expertise is the alleged Roswell saucer crash of 1947, which he has been studying since 1994. He is perhaps best known for his work on reading the telex photographed in General Roger Ramey's hands. Dr. Rudiak has also done extensive research on other topics and aspects of the Roswell incident. In addition to the Roswell case, Dr. Rudiak has also done research into other famous UFO cases, such as the Sag Harbor UFO crash, the Nellis Air Force Base UFO video, the Kecksburg UFO crash, the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, and more. And I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Rudiak for his first appearance on Eye to the Sky. Wow, you've been a busy man.
Well, not so busy recently. I've sort of been drifting out, but thank you for having me on the show, Dee.
Well, I appreciate you joining us tonight.
It's interesting you mentioned Circleville, Ohio, because that has a very clear tie-in with the Roswell case in a rather strange way with the cover story that was issued by the Air Force. But we can get into that later.
Yes, I read that as well. I found it quite fascinating as well. That was another wow moment for me.
Yeah. Well, what should we get into first here?
Well, I was thinking that we would go into the Ramey memo. That is something that has fascinated me ever since I first saw work done on trying to read the memo, and it's been a fascinating venture.
Maybe I should quickly recap the Roswell case just for listeners who aren't that familiar with it.
Certainly.
What happened is in early July 1947, a rancher named Mac Braswell, who lived about 70 miles from Roswell, came to town. He went to the sheriff's office and reported that he'd maybe found a flying saucer. He'd found some debris on his ranch, large quantities, according to most people, that he thought was very strange. And he went to town and to neighbors, and they told him about the new flying saucer phenomena that had just started. So he went to report this, and the sheriff called Roswell Base, and he got a hold of the head intelligence officer there at the base by the name of Major Jesse Marcel, who's a famous character in the Roswell case. He consulted with the base commander, Colonel Blanchard, who sent him and the head of the counterintelligence corps out to Braswell's ranch. And then they came back, and Marcel reported to Blanchard, and then the next day Blanchard issued a press release saying that they had recovered a flying saucer and were flying it to higher headquarters. And the press release, we're going to be talking about Walter Haught later on, was issued by the public information officer, Walter Haught, who had some interesting things to say recently. Anyway, so Marcel is flown to Fort Worth. This turns out to be higher headquarters, and that's the head of the 8th Air Force, and that's General Roger Ramey. And then Ramey has a press conference. They show a weather balloon. Photos are taken with Marcel and Ramey, and also his chief of staff, Colonel DeBose. And when we get to the Ramey memo, in one of those photos, there's a piece of paper in Ramey's hand, and there's an angle on the camera. There's three other photos of Ramey holding this piece of paper, but he's showing the back of the paper. In one photo, you can catch an angle of the front of the paper, and you can see that there's printing on it. And this was first noticed about 20 years ago, and a fellow named Brad Sparks, a researcher, at that time tried to blow it up and read what was there, and he picked out words weather balloons and disc on the memo, and that was about it. And then about in 1994, the Air Force had what they called a high-level government organization look at it, and they claimed that they couldn't read anything. And then in 2000, or 1999, the photographer by the name of James Bond Johnson organized a group. They got the negative still exists. They blew it up, and they took a stab at it, and they were reading a lot more. And the word that really jumped out at people at that time was the word victims that they picked out, which I agree with. So that's the infamous Ramey memo. And then I ordered blow-ups of the memo, and I, over a period of about 2 years, I was trying to piece it together. So it's not very easy to read, and I had to apply a lot of linguistic techniques to it to try to figure out what was there. But the key words in the memo are weather balloons, disc, and victims. And this all indicates that, and I and Brad Sparks also see the word Roswell in there. So this all indicates this message clearly has to do with the Roswell incident. And that's, so let's take it from there.
Okay. Also on your website, roswellproof.com, for anybody listening who'd like to follow along as we're discussing this, if you go to his website, roswellproof.com, on the left, is a link going to full text reconstruction of the Ramey memo. And you can see for yourself how difficult of a task this was, because it, you know, the more you blow up a picture, the more grainier it gets and the more difficult it gets to decipher what's there, correct?
That's correct. I think if you go to the main page, I have a link there called Critical Phrases in the Ramey Memo. And if you click on that, there'll be two phrases that I think are, you know, essential to this. And I read these as, and the victims of the wreck. And most people who have looked at this also see victims of the wreck there. And then the other phrase I interpret is, in the disk they will ship. And everybody agrees that the words the disk are in there. They disagree about the other words. So anyway, you know, why is General Ramey referring to the victims of the wreck and the disk? You know, if this is just about weather balloons, which is the official story then and now. So people may want to go there if they have their computers.
This is true. And you know, looking at this, I was looking over it again today, just, you know, to keep information fresh in my mind for tonight. You know, it pointing out, it is very difficult to see the letters in the type fonts that you use, showing what, you know, through your work you've been able to extrapolate what these words are. You've used the actual teletype font of the era.
Yeah, I got the actual teletype, some of them sent the same day, and, you know, extracted the font and used that for comparison. And I did a few other things, like the paper, you know, in the photo is slanted, and so that sort of compresses the letters, so I stretched the letters out to proper proportions. And I highlighted the contrast, and I stripped out, you know, some of the grain between the lines. So that all makes it a little easier to read. But, you know, if people have the image in front of them, I think one of the key points I make is that these aren't arbitrary interpretations. For example, the word victim, if you look at that first letter, it has to be either a V or a Y. And it's a you can count the letters. You know, these letters each occupy the same space. You know, it's like a typewriter. And so you can line up the letters in various columns and very accurately count the number of letters in each of these words. And so it's a seven-letter word, and the second letter looks very much like an I, and then I think the fifth letter looks like an I, and the sixth letter looks like a V or an M or an N, and to me the last letter looks like an S. And so you can go through the English dictionary with search engines and determine how many, you know, words could possibly fit there. For example, if you just use V, I, I, and S, there's only six words in the English language that could possibly go in there. And you come up with words like violins and virgins. And the other words don't make any sense in the context of Roswell and what was going on, but the word victims does make sense. So that's what, when I talked about earlier about linguistic constraints, that's what I'm talking about. The word has to make sense in the context of what was happening at the time, and also needs to be grammatical and make sense in the context of the words around it.
Exactly. Also in the memo, it speaks, you know, from what you've been able to, what you and others have been able to extrapolate from it. It also mentions the use of using weather balloons as a good cover story.
Yeah, I think everybody who's looked at this intensively agrees that weather balloons isn't about what was found. It was about the cover story they were putting out. They interpret the words around the words, you know, around weather balloons a little differently than I do. But everybody sort of sees that as being the you know, what the public was being told, not what was found. And so I interpret it as the next sent out PR, press release of weather balloons, as being the phrase there. So the other important thing about weather balloons, as I mentioned before, is that everybody agrees that those words are there. And absolutely everybody, even the skeptics, agree. And so then you have to ask the question, you know, what is the likelihood that General Ramey, at the very minute he's trying to, you know, put out this story that all they found was a weather balloon, is just arbitrarily holding a message about weather balloons and it has nothing to do with Roswell. And so this is a counter to the argument of some skeptics of this message that how do you know it has anything to do with Roswell? Well, just the words weather balloons tell you that it has to do with Roswell, you know, regardless of what the other words say in the message.
Well, and then the significance that Ramey has this in his hand, while the photographs that James Bond Johnson took were being taken for.
Yeah, I mean, what are the odds that they
released to the newspapers?
I mean, it's just about zero. Obviously, if it has weather balloons, it has to do with Roswell. And then there are the other words that are universally agreed upon, which such as disk, which is in quotes. I mean, this was a brand new use of the word disk. It had never been used in relation to objects seen flying around in the sky. I mean, the term is less than 2 weeks old at the time. And it's also in quotes, which you also see all the time in the newspapers, because it was a new use of the word, and so they often put it in quotes. And so this, again, points, and plus, you know, the base, Roswell base, issued the press release saying they'd recovered a flying disc. So, again, what are the odds that this has nothing to do with Roswell, if you see the word disc in the message?
Oh, and that's indisputable that, you know, that there was a press release stating that it was, you know, that this incident happened.
Oh, yeah. Practically every newspaper in the country carried a story about, you know, Roswell. And the East Coast papers, the press release came out late in the day, so the East Coast papers weren't able to get it in there. And there was a brief mention in some of the Midwest papers, but the Western papers actually published the press release. So, you know, the evening papers out west on July 8th. So you'll see it in, like, the Los Angeles Herald Express or the San Francisco News and so forth. And some of the newspapers the next day carried it. I mean, this was a nationwide story. It was perhaps the main story of the day, and it was also an international story. I went around and I gathered up a lot of the news coverage. You know, I visited many dozens of libraries and looked up as many newspapers as I can. And there's a lot of foreign newspapers that carry this story as well. I have one from India and, you know, some of the English newspapers, and it was in France and Italy and so forth. So
I wanted to mention, too, that the photographs that Johnson took were not your typical small 35-millimeter negatives. They were a large format, weren't they?
Yeah, this was a big press camera, and it was a 4x4, 4-inch by 5-inch negative. And so, you know, much higher resolution than what you would get with a 35-millimeter camera, or, you know, even a modern digital camera, which may go to, you know, 12 megapixel, but you would need like 100 megapixel, you know, digital camera to get the same sort of resolution. So you can blow this up quite a bit, and you can just make out, you know, some of the words, some pretty well, and, you know, others it's a big struggle because they're very indistinct, and I have to do a lot of interpolation, you know, from grammar and context and so forth to try to figure out what the whole message reads. But I think, you know, we have the gist of the message. The first paragraph, and I believe this message is from General Ramey, which is, again, in dispute. There's, you know, split about 50-50 as to, you know, who sent the message. But the first paragraph to me looks like General Ramey communicating with General Vandenberg in Washington, who's at the Pentagon and the acting chief of staff, and telling him about, you know, what was going on in the field, you know, what the latest news was. And then the second paragraph is telling General Vandenberg how they were dealing with the situation. So the first paragraph, I believe, reads, you know, that they just found the disc, and the victims were being, you know, shipped to Fort Worth, possibly. And then the second paragraph, again, he's reading.
Congratulations. Here's your $20 cash back incentive on your next
one. Hello.
Whoa, what was that?
Where did that come from?
I have no idea. It could possibly come from our producer, Joe's computer.
Okay. Boy, that was a message out of the ether. Anyway, the second paragraph, I think they're talking about the... the first paragraph, they're talking about finding the disc and the victims, you know, or the casualties. They don't say aliens. They don't say who the victims are. The second paragraph is, you know, what are they going to do with these victims? Well, it's the Air Force, so it looks to me like they're flying them out. So it begins that, I believe it reads, aviators in the disk, they will ship to, and I think they're talking about the flight surgeon at Fort Worth. They're going to ship the bodies there, and they're going to do it by either a C-47 cargo plane or a B-29. And we have testimony from people associated with the B-29 flight the next day of this large crate being put into the bomb bay and chained to the bomb bay and surrounded by an armed guard. Lots of secrecy around this. And then they flew it to Fort Worth, and it was met by a mortician. And then they were, you know, flew back to Roswell and told that it was, you know, forget about it. You know, it was Raimi's furniture or something like that. But, you know, there were three crew members on the flight, you know, who've talked about this. And there were also some of the guards associated with the flight. There was a guard who was assigned to the flight. He'd never, you know, acted as an armed guard before, but he had a high security clearance. And it was like they were loading an atom bomb into the bomb bay. They go to a pit and put the B-29 over the pit, and then they surround it with curtains. And what was unusual, this is in the Tom Carey and Don Schmidt book, is they put a double layer of curtains around it, and they had four armed guards who were given orders to shoot to kill if anybody went in there. And so they were patrolling blind inside this tunnel of curtains, and they couldn't see in. And they couldn't see out, and nobody could see in. And then they loaded this crate in, and then, you know, their security detail, you know, went with the crate, and they flew to Fort Worth. So this is a well-documented flight, and the crew member even had his flight journal of the flight, had the flight number and so forth, and the, you know, time it took to fly to Fort Worth. So this was one of a number of flights out of Roswell to elsewhere that have been talked about by various people at the base. And if it were a balloon, you could fly it out in a Piper Cub. You wouldn't need a B-29, and you certainly wouldn't need multiple, you know, flights to do it.
Or armed guards.
I mean, what were the armed guards about? I mean, that's pretty absurd. There's the daughter of one of the armed guards who said it was her father who led the detail, and he told her that they were flying the bodies to Fort Worth. And there are other people at the base who talked about hearing that the bodies were being flown to Fort Worth, or at least some of the bodies. We don't know exactly what happened to the bodies. So that, I mean, it's anecdotal testimony, but it seems to be coming from a lot of people.
Well, even the pilot of one of the planes, gosh, I believe his nickname was Pappy, and I think it was Henderson, wasn't it?
Oliver Pappy Henderson. He told his wife and his daughter and his old World War II flight crew and a close business friend of his that he was the pilot who flew the bodies to Wright Field. And Wright Field is up in Ohio near Circleville. And it was the home of the aeronautical labs, you know, for the Army Air Force. And so if they, you know, during World War II, if they got a Japanese Zero and they wanted to find out what made it tick, they would take it to Wright Field, and the engineers would tear it apart and try to figure it out. And so if you had a crashed craft of some kind, it would naturally go to Wright Field for analysis. So he talked about flying wreckage to Wright Field, and it was unclear whether he actually said he flew the bodies or that he had just seen the bodies. And he talked about seeing, according to his wife and daughter, seeing three small bodies, you know, packed in ice, with rather large heads and big eyes, I believe. And that's the typical description of the aliens that's been given about, you know, by just about everybody. Small, you know, small, childlike in size, with big heads and big eyes.
Yeah, that's, you know, the typical description of the Greys. You know, and oddly enough, like you said, the use of the weather balloon explanation for the Roswell incident, having a Circleville connection, I have in front of me the article from the Circle or the Roundtown website that talks about the connection with the a farmer, the coincidentally, you know, kind of connecting with him with Brazel, found what he thought was flying discs on his property, but it wasn't just one, it was several of these things. I'm trying to skim through here real quick and get the number of them. But he called into the local newspaper saying, hey, I've got these, and they turned out to be the radar targets from weather balloons.
Yeah, in fact, if you go to my website, I have a whole section devoted to, you know, these balloon crashes, Circleville crash being among them, and also balloon demos that the military had immediately after Roswell to try to explain away everything as, you know, weather balloons. So the website is, again, roswellproof.com/ and then balloon crashes with an underscore between balloon and crashes .html. And that'll take you to, a section which shows the Circleville radar target, you know, that was recovered by the farmer. And, several other radar targets that were recovered all over the country. So there's one recovered in Bakersfield and Brawley, California, and Oxford, Ohio, Greensburg, New York, Tucson, Arizona, Adrian, Missouri. So the skeptics say they were only used by in New Mexico. Well, that's not true. In fact, the military back then and also civilian weather people were saying they were used at, you know, a great many weather stations around the country. They were developed by the military, by the Army during World War II, and then after World War II, they distributed the radar targets, you know, to the civilian military or to the civilian weather services. So they were actually reasonably common, and they weren't very exotic, and most, you know, weather people knew about them. So, to say that Marcel, the intelligence officer at Roswell, wasn't a weather person, that he wouldn't have recognized, you know, tinfoil and balsa wood. These are basically just kites as being common materials or even a, you know, weather device along with the weather balloon that was shown in the pictures is pretty absurd. You know, that's one thing that a lot of us can't get past, that nobody is that stupid. You know, you could show this stuff to a five-year-old and they're not going to be very, you know, flummoxed by it. And, you know, the tin foil is, it's been argued that aluminum foil wasn't very common back then, but that's not the case. It had been used in consumer products for, you know, over 30 years. For example, Wrigley's chewing gum and Hershey's bars have been wrapped with this same type of foil paper for 30 years. You know, prior to the Roswell incident. So everybody has encountered this stuff. It's not exotic or stuff. And the main thing is that Marcel, in addition to, you know, maybe two dozen other eyewitnesses, said that the material was very exotic in its physical properties. And the none of them described a foil with a white paper backing, which is what these radar targets were made with. Instead, they talked about a foil. Well, I talked about several types of metallic material, but one type was a foil that you couldn't tear and you couldn't cut it with a knife, and it was unaffected by flame. And if you wadded it up, it unfolded and returned to its original shape. And this is what we commonly call the memory foil. And Marcel also indicated there was another type of foil-like material that he could actually blow through like it was a fabric. So, if you get down to the details of what people are actually describing, it's quite unlike tinfoil or balsa wood, even though they describe materials that superficially were similar, you know, to these. So I think military intelligence back then, the Circleville crash was first reported on July 5th, and it got a fair amount of press play, including the photo being shown, you know, throughout the Midwest, including down in Fort Worth. So I think military intelligence looked at this, and, you know, Associated Press were saying, is this the flying disc that people are reporting? And they said, well, that's close enough, you know, you know, to that'll make a good cover story because it flies and it has a superficial resemblance to metallic, you know, thin metallic material. So let's go with that. And so the Circleville crash may have sort of been the inspiration for the weather balloon cover story that followed. At least that's the theory, you know. I think Kevin Randall, among other people, originally put this forward, and I agree with that. You know, they sort of cooked this up on the spot and ran with it.
And yeah, because the Circleville Herald carried this story, like you said, on July 5th of 1947, was just 3 days before Walter Haidt issued his famous statement to the press.
Yeah, I got a Columbus newspaper also where they contacted an officer, you know, weather officer over at the weather station near Wright Field. It's the Clinton County Air Base. And he said, this is a quote. This is from the Columbus Citizen. If you go to my webpage, I have the story there. He said, every weather station in the country uses them. So again, these weren't exactly uncommon devices that, you know, nobody was familiar with. So, there's also a very interesting telegram that was sent by a reporter from Indiana. I can't remember exactly. Kalamazoo. Okay. And this was found a few years back, and it said that he had contacted military intelligence at the Pentagon, and they said they think that the flying saucers are radar targets, you know, and that he should contact the people over in New Jersey at the Mogul Project, which is interesting because the person over in New Jersey who was referred to, a guy by the name of Colonel Duffy, who was one of the people who developed these radar targets, was supposed to be at Wright Field identifying the material from Roswell. So he was in two places at once. So this is a part of the modern day cover story of the Air Force that just falls apart when you examine it. They claim Duffy that after Marcel flew to Fort Worth, they took the material and they flew it up to Wright Field, and Colonel Duffy was at home, and they brought it over to his home, and he immediately identified it as being from Project Mogul in New Mexico, which he had previously headed. But Duffy was actually in New Jersey at the time, according to this telegram. And in addition, there were letters that he was asked about this shortly before he died, what he had supposedly seen, and he refused to say that he'd seen anything from a balloon. He says, well, it could have been from a rocket, it could have been some other type of weather device. And so he just danced around it, and he was one of the inventors of the radar target. He should have instantly identified it, but he didn't. So again, this is another aspect of it, of this whole story, that they found a radar target that just falls apart when, you know, you examine the evidence closely.
I'd like to take a step forward in time here, if you'll let me, concerning the Walter Haidt affidavit.
Okay, now I have a whole other page in Walter Haidt, but if you go to roswellproof.com/Haidt, which is H-A-U-T, and then .html, and then I have a whole discussion of this affidavit, and I have both of his affidavits. There's one from 1993, or 91 possibly, and or 1993, and then there's the one that came that he from 2002, which is very controversial, because he changed his story. And in the 1993 affidavit, he says, yeah, I put out the press release. I was contacted by Colonel Blanchard. And I'm pretty sure he must have known what he was talking about, and he probably had seen the material. But that was the extent of my involvement, as I was just the guy who put out the press release, you know, that he gave me. In 2002, the affidavit goes way beyond that. And he said he was, he came back to the base on Monday, July 7th. He became aware that Major Marcel, you know, this rancher had come to town and Major Marcel was investigating. And then on the same day, July 7th in the afternoon, he became aware of a second crash site where they had found a disc and bodies. And then at the morning meeting the next day of the general staff, which would be Tuesday, you know, July 8th, he said General Ramey and his chief of staff, Colonel DeBow, had flown into Roswell, and everybody received briefings as to what was found at the two different sites. One is the Mac Brazel so-called debris field, and the other was the closer site that was 30-40 miles north of town where they found the actual craft and bodies. And then he said the debris was passed around and nobody could identify it. It was different from anything anybody had seen. And then General Ramey, it was discussed whether they were going to tell the public about this, and Ramey said, no, we're going to cover it up. And Walter Haught said at that time he didn't know exactly how that was going to be done. But then he, shortly after the meeting adjourned, that's when he got the, you know, the information from Colonel Blanchard about the press release, which he put out in the afternoon. And then it hit the news wires at 2:30 Roswell time. And that was the story, how they'd recovered the flying disc at a rancher's place and were flying it on to, you know, higher headquarters. And he said that was basically a diversion because a lot of people in the area already knew about these crash sites, and so they were trying to divert attention away from the more remote isolated debris field site, or they wanted direct attention to that and away from the closer sites with the more incriminating, you know, craft and bodies. And then they wanted to shift attention completely away from Roswell, so they took it to higher headquarters, which an hour later turned out to be General Ramey in Fort Worth. So the icing was, he said, after the press release, you know, the phone was ringing off the hook, and Colonel Blanchard, who was a close friend of his, took him out to the base hangar, you know, Hangar 84, and showed him the craft and the bodies that were inside the hangar. So this is quite a change of story from 1993 in his first affidavit. And in all public appearances, he always says, well, I'm just the guy who put out the, you know, press release. But privately, he told this person and that, you know, that he didn't know more. So I guess we should, you know, there's issues as to who actually wrote the second affidavit and, you know, how it was done, and whether Walter Haught was a sound mind and body at the time.
And that's where I get into my point where I have issues with Walter Haught's affidavit. He signed this document before a notary on December 26, 2002. The following April of 2003, I was in Roswell, New Mexico. I wanted to see what the place was like, you know, without the festival going on, what everyday life was like in Roswell. I spent a week there. I went to the UFO Museum, and there was a gentleman there, and I'm taking myself on the tail end for not getting this gentleman's name. I'm assuming, was a volunteer there at the museum. And I asked him if it would be possible to talk with Glenn Dennis and Walter Haught. Well, I was told I could talk to my heart's content with Glenn Dennis. However, I was told that since Walter's daughter was not present, I would not be allowed to ask Walter anything because his Alzheimer's had gotten so bad that he couldn't remember anything without her there to remind him.
Well, I spoke to Walter for 2 hours in August of 2001, and he seemed fine to me at that time. So this would have been, the affidavit would have been a year and a half, a little less than a year and a half later. The affidavit was actually drafted by Don Schmidt, and the story that Don and also his daughter Julie Schuster have said is that it was based on conversations that Don Schmidt and I also I guess Tom Carey had with Walter Hodd in person and also over the phone over a period of years. And according to Julie Schuster, Don Schmidt emailed the draft. She printed out two copies. They went into a room and went over each item line by line very carefully. And then she said she left the room and left him by himself so that he could review it on his own. And she came back in and she said in both cases he made no changes. He was satisfied with the way the wording was. And at that point they went in and they had it signed before a notary, and they brought in a witness who was just a visitor to the museum. So, according to Julie Schuster, that was the circumstances under which the affidavit was reviewed and signed. It wasn't written by Walter Hodd. It was written by Don Schmidt. But it's very similar to material, about seeing the bodies in the craft that he had previously admitted to in a 2000 interview that he had with Wendy Connors and Dennis Balthauser. And Wendy brought these issues up because she, too, had heard him talking about the bodies. And he sort of admitted that to, I believe, a French film crew who had visited Roswell. And so they got that on tape. And I have, relevant sections from the tape up there on my website. It's linked, from the hot page that I have up there. So there was another witness that Kevin Randall interviewed, and I'm trying to remember his name here. I have it written down. He was a first lieutenant, Richard Harris, and Randall said he interviewed him in the mid-1990s. And his story was that he was near the base hangar, and saw Walter Hodd coming out, and Hodd said him, told him about seeing a dead alien body, and maybe he'd want to go take a look. And he had a choice of going in through the door and having a look or just forgetting about it, and he decided not to have a look. And he also said he was one of the people who covered up the paper trail of expenses involved in the recovery because he was an assistant financial officer. So, again, you have, Hodd was sort of giving out dribs and drabs, well before this. And, you don't know with, aging people. Like I said, I spoke to him in August 2001, and he didn't seem to have any unusual memory problems at the time. I mean, he certainly didn't seem to be in full-blown Alzheimer's. And the other point Don Schmidt has raised is that I don't know this for a fact. I wasn't there. He said he was examined by a doctor just before he signed the affidavit, and the doctor deemed him to be of sound mind and body. So, again, it may, as far as I know, he was at the time, and, people can deteriorate very fast, at that age. They can have a stroke or whatnot, and their memory can go. So, I don't know what condition he was in at the time he signed the affidavit. A little more than a year before, he seemed fine.
I thank you for clearing that up for me, because, like I said, I had a lot of issues with that, based on my experience just what, 4.5 months later, or less than 4.5 months later.
Well, that is interesting that you bring that up. I wasn't aware that, I know he had diabetes, you know, and you can start growing clots and so forth, and that can, you know, affect the memory, you know. Certainly saw that with my dad. He had, you know, sort of a mini stroke, and his memory just got wiped out overnight. So possibly that's what happened, you know, with Walter Haught, too. You know, he was fine, and then he wasn't. I had another thought, but it's escaped me. The thing is when I spoke to Walter Haught, he was very cagey. You know, I happened to be at the museum at the same time that Don Schmidt was, and he wrangled an interview with me, and Walter Haught wasn't anxious to talk to me. He's talked to hundreds of people, probably. And he wouldn't let me record the conversation. And Don Schmidt was well aware of what Walter had told Wendy Connors, admitting to seeing a body in a craft. And he says, see what you can get out of him. Well, I couldn't get much at all out of him. He didn't know me, and he didn't trust me. And he would say, well, anybody who says they can remember what happened, you know, 50 years ago just isn't telling the truth. And so he was dancing around it. Yeah, I just got him to talk in very general terms about what sort of people Martel and Blanchard were, and, you know, what would be standard procedure, you know, for an important press release like this. And he said, you know, if it's important, I would have to send it back to Blanchard or his aide for review, you know, so they could make sure it was written correctly. So this was a counter to the arguments that are sometimes put out, that Walter Haught, on his own initiative, put out this press release that he made the whole thing up, which was actually stated in the 1947 newspapers. They made him the scapegoat for the press release. You know, the San Francisco Chronicle, for example, called him an eager beaver press officer, you know, trying to put the base on the map. But I think it's highly unlikely that Walter Haught would have ever done that, and you know, heads would have rolled if that had been the case. I'm sure they adhered to protocol. And also Colonel Blanchard, I'm sure, adhered to protocol. He wouldn't have issued that press release without approval from the Pentagon. So it was just a ruse to divert attention and get it away from the main crash site and away from Roswell altogether. And then an hour after the release went out, General Ramey was already beginning to change the story to a weather balloon. And most people don't realize that. They change the story very quickly. You'll see a lot of websites and documentaries saying the story didn't change the next day. No, that's not the case. If you look at the newspapers like the New York Times or San Francisco Examiner, he was changing it very quickly. In fact, the Examiner, their story was sort of an exclusive because the reporter knew Ramey and called him up on the phone, and the story says Ramey described a weather balloon and a radar target to him, just like the ones they sent up every day from Oakland, California. You know, it was a carefully planned strategy to confuse the public. And it also has a psychological effect. You build up expectations, and then you dash them as something absurd. And people feel like they've been played for suckers to believe the first story. And so they tend to dismiss, you know, any subsequent flying saucer stories that might appear. And It's interesting if you read the United Press story the following day on July 9th about Roswell. The very first sentence in that story talks about how flying saucer reports had dropped off markedly, and it says as the Army and Navy launched a concentrated campaign to kill the stories. So the very first sentence in the United Press story says the military was engaged in a debunking campaign, and in fact they were holding these various demonstrations, including at Fort Worth, showing these, you know, weather balloons and radar targets and saying this is what people are misidentifying as these so-called flying saucers.
Well, I can attest to, you know, Walter having been ordered to do the press release as former Navy, I know you don't do anything unless a superior tells you to.
I'm sure there are rogue officers here and there, but this is a pretty high security base, and one of the strange things about Roswell is this, like I said earlier, this was the big news story of the day. I mean, it got front page national and international attention, and it's hugely embarrassing, you know, that your high officers at the one and only atomic bomber base in the world can't do a simple weather balloon identification. And you would think at that point the Pentagon, and this also disrupted the Pentagon routine. It talks about how they were fielding thousands of phone calls, you know, from the media. And Ramey in Fort Worth, his whole routine is disrupted. Well, you know, Ramey and the Pentagon are going to order an investigation. You know, why was this huge screw-up, you know, down at Roswell? And there would have been an investigation, and there would have been reports written. And nobody can find anything like that. There was no investigation. There were no reports. And how can that be if it was all just a big screw-up? So again, the official story doesn't jive with the reality of what the military really would have done under the circumstances.
Oh, I agree. And it wasn't just media from the United States. It was all over the world was calling. I remember reading where Walter Hart was saying that he was overwhelmed by phone calls from reporters from all over the planet almost.
Yeah, the Sheriff Wilcox also said he was receiving calls from, you know, England, you know, the Daily Mail and the Times, I believe. So, yeah, they were just, everybody remembers, you know, if they remember nothing else, they remember the phones ringing off the hook, you know, for, you know, well into the night, you know, as reporters from all over the place were calling, trying to find out what they could. So the other thing is Major Marcel, the intelligence officer, is, you know, the debunkers often try to make him the goat, saying he was an idiot. If you read his performance reviews before and after Roswell, not only was he well regarded, you know, by his superior officers, but General Ramey himself, a year later, as Marcel was being transferred to Washington for higher intelligence work, was singing his praises. He's talking about him being outstanding. I mean, that's the word he uses. And he says he's future command officer material. And why would he use descriptions like this if he was a screw-up intelligence officer who, you know, embarrassed him a year before? So again, that just doesn't add up.
Well, and then as Dr. Jesse Marcel Jr., who was on my program here a few weeks ago, said that all of these people who were involved with this, from Walter Hott to Ramey to even his father, Jesse Marcel Sr., all had great evaluations. They were never passed over for promotion. They did advance in rank as their careers progressed. So these guys weren't a bunch of mess up. They knew their jobs. They did their jobs well. And they got the shaft for it in as history comes down the line. And on that note, we need to go to a break. And we'll be back here in a few minutes here on Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network and WPRN FM 105.3 New Orleans. And welcome back. I'm DeAndre, and tonight my guest is Dr. David Rudiak. Before we go much further, I'd like to let everyone know that if they have a question that they would like to ask, for myself or my guest, Dr. Rudiak, you can email them to I to the Sky, that's I, the number 2, the Sky, at cox.net, or if you're in our Pal Talk virtual auditorium, you can either private message your question to me, or you can post them here in the chat room, or you can use your microphone on your computer. Just raise your hand in the room and we'll get you up there. David, we were talking before we went to the break about Roswell, but now I'd like to progress a little further ahead.
Okay.
2 sets of photographs that fascinate me to no end that have been studied by several photographic analysis experts are the Trent McMinnville, Oregon of 1950, May 11th, 1950, and the Rex Heflin photograph of August 3rd, 1965 in Orange County, California. I heard that you have done some work on these photographs yourself.
Yeah, in the case of the Trent photos, I actually went up and located the old Trent place, and the garage that's in the photos is still there, although the family home apparently had burned down. That's, you know, also barely pictured in the photos. There were 2 photos, and it shows a sort of classic saucer-shaped object with what looks like a little antenna on top. And one shows it in profile, sort of edge-on, and the other shows it tilted with the bottom showing. And the fact that there are 2 photos is in itself interesting. And they've been scrutinized by a number of very good photo analysts. For example, Hartman of the Condon Commission took a look at the photos, and he noticed that the underside of the one photo showing the bottom, it appeared very light, and much less so than you would expect if it were in shadow. And so he developed a scaling system. He assumed that this could show an object that's off in the distance, because the further off in the distance you get, the less contrast it has because of atmospheric haze. The light gets scattered out. So he devised a scaling system. He compared it to a shadow of a barn that was several hundred yards off, and it was of about similar lightness. So he said this appears to be a large object that's off in the distance. It's certainly consistent with that. And so he thought of all the photos he examined for the Condon Commission. This is the one set of photos that he thought was the best evidence, you know, for something anomalous up there in the sky. Skeptics have attempted to attack that since then, and for example, one argument was that maybe Trent had smudged the camera lens, and that's what caused the light scattered and lightened up the bottom of the saucer object. And Dr. Bruce McAbee came back and said, no, that doesn't work. You know, he did. Dr. McAbee is an optical physicist, and he did a very extensive analysis, and he pretty much disproved that. What I was attempting to do was try to knock down some of the other skeptical arguments that had been advanced. And so I was taking very careful measurements of this barn. There are rafters that show in the barn, and so I was measuring those. And then I reconstructed the whole scene in a computer ray tracer, which enables you to, you know, simulate different conditions, like what would the shadows be if, you know, the sun are in different parts of the sky at different times of year. So one of the arguments that was advanced against the photos was that the Trents, Mr. and Mrs. Trent, said that this took place late in the day, just before sunset. So the sun would have, and these photos, incidentally, were near McMinnville, which is near Portland, Oregon. So they said it was late in the day, just before sunset, so the sun would have been in the west. But what you see is the east side of the barn, and the rafters are casting shadows onto the barn. So a skeptic like Robert Schieffer looks at this and says, well, how can the rafters cast shadows if the sun's in the west on the opposite side of the barn? And the answer is that you can get backscatter, you know, of light. And I've taken photos of this myself. You know, it can be backscatter from atmospheric dust, or it can be from clouds in the area. And
if I remember correctly, wasn't it kind of an overcast day that those photographs were taken?
It was, and that's another argument against Schieffer is there's a power pole in the picture, and if you blow it up and look at the left and right sides, the east and west sides, there it's evenly illuminated. So Schieffer was arguing that this must have been taken in the morning instead of the late day because of the shadows. But if you look at the power pole, it should have been, you know, very strongly highlighted on the west side of the pole if it was a morning shot. And it's not. It was a hazy day, obviously, and the light was coming from all different directions. So, I mean, you can look at the various details and start knocking down the arguments of the skeptics. And another thing I noticed when I reconstructed this is there are, you know, power lines from the Trent house that went out to the barn that are in these photos. And when I put them into the 3D model and did an early morning, you know, sun at the time that Schieffer said he calculated for when the photos were taken, based on the length of the shadows on the barn, it turns out these wires should have cast noticeable shadows on a oil tank that was in the photo that was right up against the barn, and these shadows aren't there, you know, when you look at the actual photos in great detail. So that knocks down the argument again, and then there's another argument against that there was a long rafter there that should have cast a long shadow on the barn, and that's absent at the position of the sun that Schieffer said, you know, it should have been, you know, based on the shadows of the other rafters. So you can go through the arguments one by one and knock them down that, you know, it just doesn't add up, you know, the skeptical arguments. So you can't prove that these photos are genuine, you know, based on the counter arguments, which you can argue is that they're consistent with them being genuine. I don't think anybody has ever found any clear evidence of hoaxing in these photos, you know, despite lots of attempts to do so. So I don't know if there are any other questions on that. That was basically what I was attempting to do. It's interesting if there's a whole bunch of Life magazine photos that were taken back in 1950 that just went up in Google Images, and people can locate those by using search words 1950s flying saucer and then source colon Life, you know, for Life magazine. And there's like four dozen high resolution photos of the Trent Place and the Trents that Life took at the time. They've never been published before, so that's a new thing on the Trent case. And on the case of Rex Heflin, I went in there. This is actually a series of three photos that Heflin took near Santa Ana. The first photo is looking through his van window facing to the east and shows another saucer-shaped object, looks sort of like a top hat a little bit. And then there's two more photos taken out the passenger side window facing to the south, you know, showing the saucer in two different angles. And then there's a fourth photo, which he said he took a few minutes later further down the road that he was on, showing a smoke ring, which he said he thought was emitted by the object. I was convinced, although when the Condon Commission also looked at this, Hartman, and he wasn't convinced they were authentic. He thought they could possibly have been faked by a small model outside the windows. So he didn't think they were probative, whereas he thought the Trent photos were. He thought they were very good evidence. Dr. James McDonald also took a look at the case, and Ann Druffel, who was a member of NICAP and who now has possession of the photos. These were Polaroid shots. Another thing that was noticed in the first photo was that with the Polaroid camera that Heflin used, he wouldn't have been able to see the object through the viewfinder of the camera, okay, because the viewfinder on this Polaroid 101 camera is mounted on top of the camera. It's like 2 or 3 inches above, you know, the plane of the lens. It's not like a SLR camera or digital camera where you're looking right through the lens. So Heflin's explanation was, I was in a hurry, so I just quickly snapped it without having time, you know, to look through the viewfinder. So one of the things I did is I again constructed a 3D computer model, and I went out and found examples of the same van that Heflin was in. It's an old Ford Econoline van from, you know, the 1960s. And measured out, you know, the windows and the slants and so forth, and reconstructed the interior of the van. And I was trying to find the position of the camera when he took these three photos of the saucer object. So it turns out that all three camera positions are very peculiar. It verified that, yes, indeed, he wouldn't have been able to see the object through the viewfinder of the Polaroid, you know, when he was looking through the windshield and taking the picture. But what was even stranger is that he would have had to have his seat all the way back and then the camera perched on his right shoulder in order to take that photo based on the perspective and the scaling of the photo. And so that didn't seem right, and it seemed more likely that he actually took the photo from in back of the of his seat and maybe steadied the camera on the top of the seat in order to take the photo. And then the other two photos out through the passenger side, if he were actually sitting in the driver's seat, he would have had to lean way over, you know, on his side and snap them. And then again, just like in the first photo, if they were pictures of distant objects, it turns out he, again, wouldn't have been able to see them through his viewfinder. So this is pretty damning, you know. It seemed more likely that he was, you know, leaning with his stomach over the driver's seat, maybe perched on the outside and propped himself up on the motor mount that was between the driver and the passenger seat. But there was even more damning evidence that I discovered when I reconstructed the scene. There's phone poles that you can see in the first photo looking down the road and, you know, when he was shooting through the windshield. And they were able to time the exact time of day of the photo because the phone pole is casting a shadow, and you can use that, you know, just like an hourglass or a sundial. And, you know, so they got a time, I believe, of 12:38 p.m. And then you can, I was looking in the other two photos for the equivalent so I could time those photos because he said those were taken seconds later. And I finally, you know, found the shadow that, you know, disproved his story. And that was the rain. There's a side view mirror outside the passenger window. And imaged in the side view mirror is the little rain gutter that runs above the doors. And the shadow cast by that rain gutter turns out to have been from a time at least 20 minutes before the first photo was taken. Maybe even more than that, maybe half an hour or even an hour earlier. So that indicates that he actually took those second two photos before he took the first one. And not within seconds of the first one, but, you know, many minutes, you know, before the first one. So that, and there were other indications of a hoax, you know, and some of the photo details, but I don't want to go into that. So it appears this case, which I thought very highly of when I first looked at it, is almost certainly a hoax. And yet he stuck to his story, and he told it with a straight face. He was a former police officer, I believe. His boss vouched for him. Everybody vouched for him for, you know, what an honest guy he was. And I think what happened is maybe it was done as a practical joke, and then the photos got published all over the place, and he sort of got trapped, and he couldn't back out at that point. And, you know, he just got in over his head. And he also put out the story that the photos of the saucers were confiscated by two guys. This is a Men in Black type story, you know, the two guys who come up and pretend to be from the government, and then they talked him into handing over the Polaroids. And then 25 years later, he said he got a phone call, and they said, if you looked out in your mailbox, he goes out to his mailbox, and the Polaroids are back. So did this really happen, or did he just sort of manufacture the story to get the Polaroids out of circulation so they couldn't, you know, be examined any further? Then when he got the Polaroids back, he got a hold of Ann Druffel, who had investigated this back in, you know, around 1965, who was, you know, one of the NICAP people down there. And he turned the photos over to Ann Druffel, who has them now. And she and another fellow, he's a professor, I forget his name, they examined them, and they thought they were genuine. For example, I believe in the third photo, it looked, when they enhanced it, it showed what looked like a ring of smoke coming out of the back of the object, which seemed to correspond with the fourth object, where Heflin said he thought that the object left a smoke ring afterwards. So there's still little oddities like that that sort of make you wonder, you know, was he just an extraordinarily clever hoaxer? Or you know, it's a very interesting case. I'm kind of disappointed it came out the way it did, but, you know, that's the way the cookie crumbles in some of these cases, you know, that not all photo cases are genuine. In fact, most of them probably aren't. There's a lot of hoaxers out there in terms of UFO photos.
Oh, isn't that the most prevalent in the Internet now? You get a lot of these CGI things, and you're going, well, you know, is it the genuine thing, or is it CGI?
Yeah, you know, unless you have, I think, more than one person taking the photo at the same time and they don't know one another, or maybe even a movie. But even digital movies, of course, it's gotten so good that many people can fake them and turn out a pretty convincing fake. So the digital age has, in some ways, almost destroyed the value of, you know, photographic evidence. And unless, in case it's a, you know, multi-witness sighting, and maybe you have more than, you know, one set of, you know, photos or videos taken from different angles, you know, which would be very difficult to fake. So
I agree on that point.
Yeah. So, I mean, it still has value, the photography, but, you know, sometimes the cases don't work out the way you'd like them to, but you know, that's the way it is. Yeah.
Yeah. A question about the Heflin photos. You were saying about the positioning of the camera, where the camera had to be within the confines of the van.
Yeah.
Come to think of it, I never heard any stories about whether he was saying he was sitting behind the wheel, you know, of the van, or if he was in the back of the van, or where exactly in the van he was. Do you have any?
Well, he said he was in the driver's seat, and he, you know, he saw this object through his windshield, and so he snapped the first photo. He grabbed. He worked for the highway department, and they would go along these roads and check whether the brush was cleared away from the roads and so forth. And so they took cameras to document, you know, a Polaroid camera to document various sites if they had to order people to clear away the brush. What was peculiar about these particular Polaroids is that they used sort of generic Polaroid film, in which the film pack didn't have numbered film. Now, when I had a Polaroid, you know, each Polaroid had a number on it. The first one was number one, and the next one was marked number two, and so forth. These particular Polaroids, there were no numbers on them, so they could be taken in any order, and or put in any order you liked. He did say he was in the front seat, and he said he took the, you know, the first picture through the windshield, and then when it flew off to the right in the direction of the passenger side, and he could see it through the passenger window, he snapped the other two photos, which he said was, you know, within seconds afterwards. So it just turns out the camera positions are just extremely strange. And then, of course, there's this shadow evidence, which sort of disproves the order of the pictures that he said, you know, he took, you know, he took the various sequence in. So,
well, and a lot of people will point out, saying, well, what about the cloud of dust underneath that? I used to point that out myself a lot until I found out, you know, over the course of just the last few years, that it wasn't a cloud of dust underneath there. It's like a weed or a brush or something growing along the side of the road.
In fact, Frank Edwards, you know, in the same book, you know, that you read about Roswell in,
yeah,
he mentioned that.
Does
it look like a, and that looked like, you know, there's a physical interaction with the environment, which is always convincing, and it looked pretty convincing to me too. But it turns out that there were, I think, oil pipe stems in the picture or something like that. There are several of them in the picture, and just around the base of these was just dead grass, and that's all we were seeing. It just happened to be underneath, it appeared to be directly underneath this saucer object in the first one. It appears what he did is he used some sort of small model and suspended it somehow, you know, just outside the windows, and he took the pictures. And that would explain why you can see a small model through the viewfinder if it's, you know, if an object's close up because of the angle, but if it's way off in the distance in the same relative position in the sky in the photo, you can't see it through the viewfinder. So he used like a pole and nylon fishing line or something like that, and so you couldn't see the thread. And, you know, I just suspended a little model and snapped off the pictures and then made up a story to go along with it. A very convincing story. For example, he said he was talking to a supervisor in the radio, and when he saw the object, the radio cut out, and the supervisor confirmed that. It says there was some crackling on the line, and, you know, they lost contact, and that sounded like an electromagnetic interference case. And
well, that crackling to going along the bunker part could have been just a piece of paper he was crumbling.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, maybe that's what he did. And again, you know, at one point he was asked to take a lie detector test, and he says, well, I'm a former police officer. I know that perfectly innocent people can fail lie detector tests very often. And he says, if I do that, I'll lose my job. So he wanted some money ahead of time in case he failed the test. And looking back, I think he really feared he would fail the lie detector test because he knew he had faked the photos. And I'm not sure if the photos disappeared right after that or not, or, you know, the story about the two government guys in NORAD coming to his door and taking the photos. It's possible that was true. I mean, we certainly had other stories of in fact, the day after Roswell, there were photos published in the Arizona paper, Arizona Republic, I think.
Yes.
Taken by William Rhodes, again, of a saucer-shaped object, you know, the crescent in the back, very similar to what Kenneth Arnold said he saw 2 weeks before. And we know from documents that the FBI and Army Counterintelligence approached Rhodes 2 weeks later and convinced him to hand over the negatives, and they also went to the newspaper and took the prints. So such things do happen, and we have certainly other stories of either the film disappearing or when it's returned, you know, like... I'm trying to think. There was the...
I know, I'm trying to remember.
The Tremont and...
Yes.
Wherever. Well, there was the Great Falls photos that were also examined by the Condon Commission. This was what was his name, Nicholas Marietta. He took two. There are two objects, you know, disc shape objects, and again, when the Condon, you know, Hartman of the Condon Commission examined them, he says these look genuine. He says I can't explain away this movie. Marietta says when the Air Force finally returned that film, they clipped off oh, like the first, I forget, like 20 inches of the movie or something like that, he said. He said, which very clearly showed that these were discs, you know, not just spots of light. And the same is true of Newhouse, you know, the Navy photographer who took these famous a famous movie near Tremont in Utah, near Salt Lake City, of multiple objects, you know, maneuvering around in the sky. And he and his wife and his son all said that, you know, before he could get his camera out, you know, just like your story, you know, you told me during the break you couldn't get your camera out in time to take a picture. He says when they first saw these objects, they were very clearly, you know, large silver discs. And by the time he got his camera ready, they'd moved off into the distance. But the first section of the film, again, was much clearer in showing their disc shape. And when he finally got a copy, not even the original film back, they had removed that. So again, there are other stories, you know, where the photographic evidence has either been confiscated or tampered with. So it's certainly not out of the question in the Heflin case that maybe, you know, maybe two guys did come into the door thinking that he had genuine photos and they took it away from him.
And then when they found out 28 years later that it's not real, give them back.
Yeah.
You know,
maybe that's what happened. You know, maybe he was really telling the truth about that. We don't know. I mean, there's certainly a lot of Men in Black stories, you know, where the government guys come and tell you not to talk about it or take away the evidence.
But did you notice they didn't ever tell him not to talk about it?
No, no. They just said, please hand over the photos. They left the photo of the smoke ring. And we still don't know where he got the photo of the smoke ring. I've seen, I go to the Burning Man festival, you know, in near Reno, Nevada every year, and they have a big smoke ring generator which produces beautiful large smoke rings very similar to what you see in that photo. But where did he get that back in 1965?
Well,
he was near a Marine base, and maybe they did a bombing run or something like that. And
yeah, he was near El Toro Air Force Base as well.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. I can't remember what it was I was reading in, but it was talking about Rex Heflin's photograph and the smoke ring. And the writer of this book said that there was also a photograph that was taken by a guy stationed at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, that had several photographs out, rather, of the smoke ring. And he was saying, well, you know, it looks a lot like the Heflin smoke ring photograph of the smoke ring, but this was caused by our big guns.
Yeah.
Practice firing these big guns, you know, like the cannons or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, well, in Burning Man, they use a big blast of hot air, I guess, mixed with oil to generate the smoke, and you just get this updraft, you know, through the center of the ring, and it starts swirling around, and then it spreads out into this fine, delicate ring. So they're relatively easy to generate if you have a lot of heat and, you know, like from a bomb or a gun. Or, you know, people blowing smoke rings, you know, with cigarettes.
Yeah.
So it's the same sort of, you know, mechanism going on. The first photo that he took through the windshield shows the object. It has like a dome on top, you know, the top hat thing, and there's a dark band across it. So it was speculated that maybe that was the smoke somehow adhering around the top of the saucer. And what I think that was really showing is I discovered that because of the shading of that was on the saucer, this had to be a reflective object. And if it were off in the distance and reflecting the surrounding countryside, it would have been very light there. But if it were a model reflecting the dark interior of the van, you know, if the model was just outside the windshield, then that could account for that dark ring that you see on the top. So that was another little piece of, you know, it's not conclusive evidence, but I think that's where that dark ring, or not the ring, but a dark band that you see in that first photo comes from.
Okay, another incident I'd like to move on to is the Nellis Test Range, the S-30 UFO.
Right, and that is, I think the website there, it's at my website, I have a long discussion. If you go to roswellproof.com, there's a link to the Nellis page, I think.
You see, I've got that site open myself today. I scroll way back up. On the left side of that page, it says other research. And if you click on the picture above it, it'll take you right to that page.
Right.
And you got to scroll down a little bit to where it says Nellis UFO. And that talks about you're looking into this. And gosh, doesn't it also show the video clip there, too?
I have a tiny bit of the video clip that I've stabilized the object. And that's, okay, I have a page called Nellis_main.html, which has a bunch of links to other, you know, information. What's unusual about this is we believe it was filmed in November of 1994, and the Nellis Range is an area about 100 miles northwest of Las Vegas, Nevada, out near the Nevada test site where they do the atomic bomb tests. And this is an area where the Air Force goes out and they train their fighter pilots. So they, they do bombing runs and strafing runs and fire missiles and attack, phony airstrips and so forth and phony radar sites that they set up out there. So they have various video cameras and radar sites, distributed around the Nellis Range, which they use to photograph the pilots as they're training, and then that gives them feedback later on. And it's a very highly monitored site. They don't want anybody wandering in there by accident or deliberately, in part because it's a danger to them. You know, if you have jet planes, flying around there and firing missiles, a civilian plane can very easily be knocked down. So they very carefully make sure that nobody goes in there. And it's heavily photographed, and there's radar all over the place. So one of these cameras and radar stations picked up this strange object, and they see it off in the distance, and there's also the range operators commenting on it, and they say, "What is that?" And they say, "Well, I don't know." And then it's off in the distance, and then you can see it getting bigger and bigger, and it seems to be approaching the camera and the radar. And for a period of time, they get a good radar return, and you know how far away it is. And this is important in later calculating how fast it's going and, how far away it is and the altitude and how it's maneuvering. And then it gets relatively close. It gets to within about 2 miles of the station. And that's the little stabilized image I have on my discussion page of the Nellis, right at the very top, where you see it looks like a multi-lobed object, and it's rotating around. And some people say, well, it looks like a cluster of balloons. And yes, it does. But when I actually went back and used the radar and the changing size to calculate how far away it was at various times in the video, this thing is getting up to 700 miles an hour, and it's also rapidly accelerating and decelerating and going into steep climbs. And so that's obviously not a balloon, and you can look at it, and it's obviously not a helicopter, it's not a jet, it's not an airplane. There's no obvious external propulsion system like jets or propellers or rockets. There's no trail to it, and yet it's this bulbous structure. It looks like maybe four or five spheres all attached together, and flying up at speeds of 700 miles per hour. And it seems to be glowing. There, at one point when it starts to go into a steep climb, at first it just looks like a white bubble with a dark area down below, you know, sort of like a triangular shaped area. And then all of a sudden you see these like two spheres, white spheres sprouting up on the underside where this dark area was. And at that point it starts to go into the steep climb. So it's unlike anything I've ever seen before. It certainly isn't a classic flying saucer or a sphere or a, you know, a cylinder or a triangle like is often associated with, you know, UFOs. So we don't know what it is. Some people speculate it's a secret test craft that was deployed over there.
Well, then, why, if it was that, then why would the guys that were monitoring?
Absolutely.
This,
in fact,
this
I have
particular camera saying, "Holy cow, what is it?" type attitude.
There's actually two videos. There's one which shows it pretty close up, and you can see the detail. And then there's another one from another site where it's way off in the distance. It's, I forget, like 7 miles away. And it's flying pretty slow. It's flying at about helicopter speeds. But what's mysterious about it is that they can't identify it. They call into central control, and central control doesn't know what it is. Nobody knows what it is out there, you know. And yet this is a highly monitored site. They know everything that goes in and out of there. So, and the same with the other video showing it in much greater detail. They're arguing with one another, and one says, "Oh, that those are balloons," and they said, "No, those aren't balloons." And the other says, "Well, it must be a helo." And says, "That's no helo." I mean, conversation like that, and you hear them talking to the other range operators, and nobody has any idea what this is. So that in itself is damn peculiar. The theory that some skeptics advance is, well, you know, it could be a test object. It's near Area 51, you know, Area 51, the infamous Area 51, I think is like 30 miles away. So maybe it's a secret craft they developed there. They fly it in here to see what the response of the range operators will be to the strange craft. Well, I suppose that's possible. If it is one of our own craft, it isn't like anything else up there that's flying, you know. What is the propulsion system, and how can it be non-streamlined and yet fly at, you know, near to supersonic speeds? I mean,
and where's the wings?
Where's the wing? Yeah, what's holding the thing up? And
yeah,
you know,
there's nothing evident there to show, you know, some form of lift to be generated.
No, and the other thing is when I plot the speeds and accelerations, it doesn't fly like any other object I've seen. The accelerations aren't that dramatic. I mean, although I think at one point it hits like 9 G's, but a jet plane can do that. But it rapidly accelerates, and then all of a sudden it rapidly decelerates, and then it accelerates again. So the speed is going up and down. It's like a roller coaster. It's up and down and up and down. And I don't know of any plane or jet or rocket that flies like that.
Well,
and again, even though it may look like balloons, it flies like 10 miles in 2 minutes. You know, it's got an average speed of 300 miles an hour.
And this object seems to rotate in random directions as well.
Yeah, I did an animation of this. Again, using a ray tracer, from the perspective of the object itself, it's like you're looking over the top of the object as it's flying by this radar station. And it seems like it's rotating, like part of it is rotating the face towards the radar station. Like maybe it's giving a look over, it detects it's being painted on radar, so it goes to take a look at whatever is examining it on radar. The other interesting thing about this, which I just recently figured out when I went to Google Earth and looked at the area, is this object, when it's initially sighted, is only about 6 miles from where they were holding the underground nuclear test there at the Nevada test site. In fact, if you look at the Google Earth map of the various underground sites, it's probably within about 10 miles of 30 underground tests that they've held there over the years. So you know, it could be like a lot of these other instances where UFOs appear over our nuclear areas, our nuclear bases and our, you know, nuclear missile silos, which they shut down back in, what was it, 1975? And
Sounds about right.
Yeah, you know, there are there's been a whole bunch of incidents where, you know, UFOs have appeared over our missile sites and seemingly reprogrammed the missiles and shut them down, or even sent them into launch code, and they had to manually shut them down. And one of the disclosure witnesses, Robert Sala, talks about this, where he was one of the missile officers, and he was there, and, you know, one of the guards calls in and says there's this huge glowing object outside the gate, and then right after this, you know, I forget if the missiles were actually shut down or they went into launch. I think he said they went into launch sequence and they had to manually shut it down so they didn't launch. So, Robert Hastings has done a lot of research into this. He just came out with a book called UFOs and Nukes, where he's interviewed like 100 different people, you know, who've worked at the missile silos and the various atomic bases and so forth, or have been associated with nuclear weapons and have had UFO incidents associated with them. So I could imagine that this is just another UFO wandering over a nuclear area and checking it out, because there are all these bomb craters, you know, from the underground tests that are out there, and I'm sure there's residual radiation. So they're just having a look and what are the humans up to here?
Well, let's see if they can,
you know,
play with
I don't
mess
know.
With their minds, yeah. Turn off their toys.
Yeah. They seem to be very interested in our nukes, you know, and they are, you know, there's I don't know. It's unclear whether they fear them or whether, you know, they're just sort of toying with us. I mean, there's the Robert Jacobs story. I don't know if you're familiar with that. But
he was stationed
at Vandenberg Air Force Base, and they operated this giant camera to take pictures of their missile launches. And he said during one of the missile launches, you know, they get the film back, and then he's called in, and they project the film onto a screen, and he says there was this disc circling around the missile in flight, you know, 100 miles downrange, and shooting rays into the missile. I believe it was an Atlas missile being shot over the Pacific, and knocks the missile out. It starts to tumble, and it falls out of, you know, out of flight.
Well, and then this thing was flying, literally flying circles around this missile, traveling, 1,000 miles an hour?
Oh, I bet it was traveling 12,000 miles an hour or something by then. You know, it was way downrange, and, you know, in a semi-orbital flight, you know, a ballistic.
And then didn't his commanding officer come forward years later and back up his story?
He said, you know, there were the two government guys there again, you know, the stern-looking government guys. And they said, well, what do you, you know, and they're saying, well, what do you think this is? And he says, well, it looks like a flying saucer, you know. And they said, don't ever talk about this. And, you know, again, the film disappeared, another one of these missing film things. And then years later, his commanding officer, a fellow named Mannheim, says, you know, if this ever comes up again, he says, I'll back you up. And he did. He wrote a letter saying that this incident happened, and, you know, and the so the Phil Klass tried to destroy.
Phil Klass, the one everybody loves to hate.
You know, he got him fired. He Jacobs became a university professor, and he got him fired from one job. And, but, you know, Jacobs was stuck by his story, and his commanding officer backed him up. So, you know, there's these little demonstrations, you know, where they say, well, you have your destructive toys, but look at what we can do, you know.
Yeah.
Which I think is sort of telling our military, don't mess around with us. You know, however great you think you are, we're better. So, And I think, you know, the missile silo incidents are sort of the same thing. They say, look, guys, you know, if we really wanted to, we could start a nuclear war. And, you know, and we could have you wipe yourselves out. You know, so this is a demonstration that we can do this. So, again, don't mess around with this. We're capable of all sorts of things. And I think a lot of these incidents, which may seem rather strange, are just demonstrations on their part. And it's also sort of a form of psychological warfare. It's intimidation, you know, in case our military gets some ideas as to confronting them at some point.
Okay, we have about 2 minutes left. Holy cow, where's the 2 hours going?
Yeah, oh, really? Okay.
Do you have any speaking engagements coming up?
I've been invited to the Roswell Festival for the first time coming this summer. So I don't know what I'm going to talk about. Maybe I'll talk about the Ramey memo. That seems to be the most interest there.
My good friend Peter Robbins has been asked again to come back and coordinate the city and the museum's joint conferences for this coming summer's events.
And I'm sometimes invited to the Ozark UFO Festival in April. And I haven't received an invitation this year, but maybe one's coming. So we'll see. No, I don't have any upcoming engagements other than that.
Okay, and we've got about a minute to go. You want to tell your website address again?
It's roswellproof.com. Roswellproof is all one word. And I've got a whole bunch of newspaper stories in Roswell. I have a bunch of witness transcripts. I have a whole section devoted to witness testimony about debris. I have a number of important witnesses like Glenn Dennis, the Roswell mortician, and all the people who back up his story about, you know, the small alien bodies. There's a number of, you know, there's Walter Hott, who we talked about. There's some other people. There's an Army photographer named Frederick Benthal who said he photographed the aliens, you know, out in the field. You know, Oliver Pappy Henderson, there's a page devoted to him. Eli Benjamin's another first-hand alien body witness. He said he was an MP and he escorted the alien bodies from the hangar back to the base hospital, and one of them was alive. And, you know, there's a number of other very interesting stories told by various military and, you know, civilian people. There's a whole slew of Roswell witnesses. The bunkers typically try to say it's only Jesse Marcel, and he was an idiot intelligence officer. But everything he said is backed up by, you know, all sorts of people, including Colonel DeBose over in, you know, Fort Worth, who was General Ramey's chief of staff, who said, yeah, it was a cover story, you know, the weather balloon part. So,
unfortunately, we're all out of time.
Yeah.
I do want to encourage everybody to check out Dr. Rudiak's site. It is, like, as you can tell from listening to him, there's a lot of information there. It can take you days to go through it all.
I think there's like 150 different pages of information there.
It's probably
like 500 or 600 pages altogether if it were printed out. Yeah, there's a lot of...
There you go. Like I said, I encourage you all to check it out. It's a great website. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have left for tonight. I want to thank everyone for tuning in and also thank all of those who joined us in the Palfrock Auditorium. Stay tuned tonight for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Tonight, her guest is Robert Tyndall. And join us again next Saturday on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, when my guest will be Canadian researcher Chris Rutowski. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone. And we're clear.